Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. In facing the great challenge of global climate change, we have an unlikely and powerful ally, business leaders. An increasing number of business leaders are waking up and taking action to promote sustainability. Encouraging this important trend is a little known but vitally important nonprofit organization called Ceres. For over 25 years, Ceres has been bringing environmentalists and capitalists together to forge a new sustainable business model that generates prosperity while protecting the health of the planet. Today, Ceres has grown into a powerful network of investors, companies, and public interest groups that accelerate the adoption of sustainable business practices and solutions to build a healthy global economy. Our first guest today is Ann Kelly, Senior Director of Public Policy at Ceres.
Hey, welcome to the show. Hi, everyone. I'm Bobby Elias. Our show is Let's Create a Better World.
Our first guest today is Ann Kelly, Senior Director of Public Policy at Ceres, who will tell us more about their exciting work. Following Ann will be our second guest, Chris Miller, the Social Mission Activism Manager at Ben & Jerry's, a member of Ceres and one of the leading socially responsible companies in the world. Ann Kelly, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much, Eleanor. Delighted to be here.
Well, I admire your work, and Mindy Lubow, the big leader, I guess, at Ceres, is a longtime friend and colleague, and been tracking it and amazed at what you all have done. But for our listeners who haven't heard yet of Ceres, can you explain what is Ceres and why is its work so important?
Sure. Ceres is a 27-year-old nonprofit organization based in Boston. We were founded in the wake of the Exxon Valdez spill, which your listeners may remember was 1989. And that was at a time where the anti-apartheid movement was alive and well. And a group of investors and a group of environmentalists came together to really champion the notion that investors should be active in the companies that they own and should demand certain standards of behavior. That was a long time ago. We now have grown to include a investor network on climate risk that mobilizes shareholder activity and takes public policy positions. We have investors, over 100 investors, with a collective over $14 trillion of assets under management. And again, we're a nonprofit, but we direct the advocacy efforts of those investors. And we have about 65 companies that we work with as they pursue their path of sustainability, which includes robust disclosure and, of course, reducing their carbon footprint, cleaning up their supply chains. And then I run our public policy shop, which is about bringing economic messengers to Capitol Hill and to state houses in an effort to transcend the politics with a tight economic message around sustainability.
That's great. Well, I happen to think that the work you all are doing at Ceres is among the most important work happening in the world. We're all a bit frustrated with our federal government at dragging its feet and being dysfunctional, but business leaders, once they're convinced action is needed, can take action pretty rapidly, and it's really ultimately what's needed anyway. So I love that you're working directly with the companies to help them become more sustainable. So your particular role, as you mentioned, is the Senior Director for Public Policy. What exactly does that involve?
Well, that involves specifically mobilizing interested businesses and investor leaders to take their message to lawmakers. As you know, what we discovered around 2008 was that as much as individual efforts are vital, and they truly are, companies can do great things on their own, that most of their operational goals would be met much easier if we had a legislative framework that really supported, for example, increases in renewable energy purchasing, increases in energy efficiency. Pretty much every area of sustainability leadership could be advanced if we had the right rules in place. So it actually came from some of our corporate members that said, you know, why don't we mobilize and work together and see if we can't get some bigger systems change? You know, an example would be for getting a price on carbon, either at the state level or at the federal level. And those measures, believe it or not, are being robustly discussed now on both sides of the aisle. But it takes business leaders and investors to come forward and say, look, here, let us tell you the economics. Because, you know, lawmakers often don't fully appreciate, well, they don't fully appreciate the nature and the impacts of climate change for the most part. Some do. Let me say, on both sides of the aisle, we are really seeing some points of light and some encouraging news and from our federal policymakers as well as at the state level. But we felt the message that these economic leaders could bring was vital to the debate. And I should say the investor and business leaders we've brought to Capitol Hill span the full range of political and views, and they're located throughout the country. But they bring a collective message which says we've done the math. And we have to do something about climate change. The cost of inaction is far greater than the cost of acting swiftly.
That's great. And you're also the director of the Business for Innovative Climate and Energy Policy at CERES, which has the wonderful acronym BICEP. And that's the coalition of 38 companies, which I'm impressed that you've got such a big range, as you mentioned, all the companies involved, but including Nike, Starbucks, and eBay. I mean, these are not just your usual suspects of Ben and Jerry's, who we love and is an industry leader, but it's just amazing to me that you've branched out so much. And what does BICEP do?
Well, you're correct in your first comment that we have a wide range of companies including Mars, L'Oreal, Kellogg, General Mills, you know, companies from the Midwest, and the full range of sectors. And that is the group that essentially was kicked off in 2008 and has mobilized. The core group is the 38 companies you mentioned, but it's also helped to enable a much larger network of companies to have the courage to stand up, to sign up, to call for a strong global deal in Paris, to go to Paris, to actually be active in those negotiations, and to be active at the state level in various policy measures. So they are the elite group of extremely active companies, and they deserve credit for that. They've also helped to enable a much larger network that we work with on various measures to mobilize support for, as our name suggests, meaningful climate and energy policy. And we have to give Nike credit for that fantastic name. They're the ones who came up with BICEP.
That's wonderful. So you lobby on Capitol Hill and in state houses around the country on a set of issues regarding sustainability. What are your top priorities?
Well, over the last 18 months or so, we, of course, have been mobilizing business and investor interests around support of the President's Clean Power Plan, which really is the crown jewel of his overall climate action plan. And that's a set of regulations designed to reduce emissions in the electricity sector for new and existing power plants. That's the set of rules. We've mobilized hundreds of companies to say, yes, it's time. Many of those companies would have preferred a congressional legislative solution, but absent that, as the President noted, he was able to use the extremely versatile and robust Clean Air Act. Now, that is currently on pause because of the Supreme Court case, but we did also, there are several companies who weighed in with amicus briefs, which is just a way of saying they fully and completely support the implementation of the plan, support the EPA. This is a plan that's going to be implemented at the state level, so we're encouraging states to keep going with their state implementation plans, and that's been of extreme importance. We've also pushed for strong renewable portfolio standards at the state level, and those are just laws that, frankly, just make it easier for companies to source renewable energy at the state level. And all of these things just help to encourage the transition to a low-carbon economy, which is exactly what the Paris Agreement is all about. We see the direction of travel. We see that we have a net zero emissions goal by the end of the century. Again, companies have done the math. Companies have seen their supply chains suffer from extreme weather, from damage to various crops and commodities, from sugar to rice to cocoa to corn to leather to cotton. And they've had enough. They've also seen the impact on their communities. and many of them have their manufacturing facilities in places that are extremely vulnerable to temperature change and to flooding and to extreme weather. So we also support climate adaptation efforts and climate adaptation funding. At the federal level, it takes the form of something called the Green Climate Fund, which we've gotten behind. And finally, you know, we are actively now engaged in conversations with lawmakers around a price on carbon. We need to price carbon. And the phrase there you may have heard, Eleanor, is tax what you burn, not what you earn. So there's some conversations about a tax shifting rather than, you know, certain taxes we may shift and have a trade-off and actually tax carbon itself. I'm sure you've heard of this already. And there's tremendous bipartisan support for such a scheme, as there is for most of the world's leading economists have agreed that this is the simplest way to reduce carbon emissions. So those are the things.
Well, that's impressive. So, you know, the main goal here is we want to reduce the carbon emissions, which, of course, we all know is the major factor behind the global warming and the global climate change. So you're doing a lot with the companies themselves and amplifying their voice in Congress and in state halls around the country to encourage energy efficiency, promote renewable energy, basically move towards our clean energy economy.
That's right. And I should say the stunning finding of this week that your listeners may be familiar with is that for the first time, transportation emissions from transportation have actually surpassed those from our electricity sector. So an enormous amount of our work must necessarily be focused on fuel economy, on low-carbon fuel standards, in a major way on the electrification of the transportation sector, and that will take many forms. That's a market question of making certain that we're pricing electric vehicles right so that consumers will buy them, so that companies will be encouraged to electrify their fleets. And in the interim, we've just supported stronger standards for trucks, for major trucks that ship nearly all of our goods across the country. And those trucks, it turns out, can be far more efficient. They average about 6 miles to the gallon. And fortunately, the EPA has put out regs that will be finalized soon that will call for those trucks to be far more fuel efficient, which is the direction we also have to go in.
Right. That sounds great. And I hear that you're mobilizing the business community to bring that very powerful voice into the halls of government and hopefully talk sense into them and where the good stuff is happening to support it, like what President Obama has been doing with the Clean Action Plan. Do you also work with companies to increase their own operations, like increasing their own energy efficiency and use of renewable energy?
Yes, and Ceres beginnings are all about working with companies on their own operational challenges. So half of our office is devoted to working directly with companies on a confidential basis on those very specific energy, water, and sustainability challenges. So yes, a big part of our office is devoted to just that. And it turns out most of the companies that have been comfortable enough to join BICEP and to become advocates are pretty much walking the talk. So they've already worked on their own operations. They've already made tremendous strides. Some of them, like Mars and Nestle and VF Corporation, having committed to purchase 100% renewable energy. There are 54 companies now in a program called RE100 that have committed to be 100% renewable. This includes Google and others. And that's creating just a tremendous market pull that's really shifting the demand for renewable energy in a major way. And several of our other NGO colleagues are supporting this effort, and we're now getting into the details of transactions to allow companies to purchase renewable energy, which you might expect is creating some disruption in the electric power sector. We work with the electric power sector as well. But that transition, though not easy, is certainly afoot, and it's something that we need to actively encourage.
Yeah, that's very impressive. So you've got 54 companies now committed to be 100% renewable in their energy. So do they have the access to that renewable energy, or are we still kind of stuck with the electric companies predominantly very heavy in the fossil fuels?
Well, this is the exciting transition of the day, and it's all, we should all talk to our power companies about the way in which they are able and willing to become a 21st century utility. It raises the question of what does it mean to be a 21st century utility, and what is the appropriate energy mix and energy portfolio for power companies today. Obviously, it's very complicated. We have experts on our team that spend all of their time on this, and it varies tremendously. And there are power companies that are seeing the light and are making those necessary transitions. Certainly there are others that have had a more difficult time and are a bit entrenched in their old model, which is risky because, you know, that suggests that they might have assets that will become stranded, because if we're to come anywhere close to meeting the 2-degree limit that was just reinforced by the Paris Agreement, most of those fossil fuels have to remain in the ground. So we're doing everything we can to encourage laws and regulations that will incentivize that transition to renewable energy on the part of the power sector. And, of course, again, putting a price on carbon, everyone agrees, would be something that could quickly stimulate and expedite that transition.
Absolutely, and I want to talk about the price on carbon in just a minute, but before we do, I was really struck that one of your members in BICEP is IKEA, based in Sweden, that's got 370 stores in 47 countries. They provide household furniture and goods. That is a massive operation, and the idea of IKEA moving towards renewable energy and sustainability is really exciting. Do you happen to know what kind of progress IKEA has made to be more sustainable?
Well, where to begin? We could do a whole show just on IKEA's leadership because there would be so much to talk about. Of course, you know, they're based in Sweden. They also have a very, very strong U.S. presence. They are headquartered in Pennsylvania. One of the most interesting anecdotes they tell is regarding their own consumer base. So they have customers coming in to buy towels, and they go out buying solar panels. You can actually go and purchase solar panels for your home at IKEA. They've made tremendous strides in terms of their recycling, of not allowing waste to landfill, tremendous strides. They, too, of course, have committed to be 100% renewable energy. They have wind and solar facilities throughout the world. I want to mention one other thing they've done that your listeners might not suspect, but it's sort of the next frontier that I think we all have to work on, and Ceres is certainly going after this in a big way, and that's sustainable agriculture. IKEA's contribution to reminding all of us that we have to move away from beef, and how profoundly unsustainable beef can be, for the obvious reason, not only water use, but because of the methane emissions caused by cattle, is that they have promoted veggie balls in conjunction with their classic Swedish meatball. They're now selling veggie balls and promoting them vigorously, and they're very tasty. I was able to have some of them when I was in Paris. So they're an interesting company because they're trying to really bring the ethics right to their consumer base. And for years and years and years, of course, they haven't given out bags, for example. You have to buy your bag, which seems like a small thing, but if you understand the collective action impact of that, it's quite large. So from soup to nuts, IKEA has really walked the talk, and they are also active on the policy front at the state, federal, and international level. And they've also gotten behind the organization of a much bigger group called We Mean Business that has promoted the economic case for global climate action at the global level, and they were very active in the Paris Agreement. So I could talk about that company for a very long time.
That. Yeah, and would you say that IKEA is kind of the poster child, showing what a company can do and leading the way? Or I know it's hard. It's like asking a mother who her favorite child is, but who are the stars in the business community that are really standing out for their work on sustainability?
Well, there are several, and I'd be remiss if I did not mention our good friends at Ben & Jerry's. And as Crystal explained to you, I mean, they have basically integrated their social mission into the business, and that's really at the core of what Ceres has long said companies need to do. I'm a huge fan of the B Corps, the B Corporations, the benefit corporations I'm sure your listeners know about. That's very, you know, worth Googling, because the whole corporate model there is what Ceres has stood for a long time. Really, not just an add-on benefit, a green this or a green that, but really embedding a sustainable ethic to the core of the corporation, the B standing for benefit, also noting that a corporation serves all stakeholders, not just shareholders, but really serving and valuing their employees as well. So Ben & Jerry's has a great story to tell. They're owned by Unilever, of course, which has its own fantastic global story to tell through its various sustainable living initiatives. They have been an absolute poster child in this space. I also have to give hats off to many of the IT companies, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple, Amazon, and Microsoft. Those four, you know, filed an amicus brief in the Clean Power Plan case that I mentioned earlier. And Facebook has joined this group that has very aggressively started to procure renewable energy at the state level and started to make their data center siting decisions in part based on the renewable energy portfolio of a given location. That's really important and impactful. So I really have to compliment any company, the ones I mentioned, but any company that has specifically proactively gone after the procurement of renewable energy, because that's really shifting the energy portfolio of a state, of a country, eventually, and of the globe in the long term.
Right, and it's exactly the direction we want to be heading. Now, you mentioned about the importance of putting a price on carbon, and I recently had dinner with Prime Minister Gro Brundtland, the first woman Prime Minister of Norway, who, as we know, ran the Brundtland Commission, which came up with the whole concept of sustainable development years ago. And I asked her at dinner, I said, what's the most important thing we can do to address global climate change? And she said, put a price on carbon. So it's definitely at the top of the list of what needs to happen. It may be the single most effective action we can take to reduce carbon emissions and slow global warming. And you just mentioned about Ben & Jerry's as being one of the leaders here in this whole sustainability movement. I understand Ben & Jerry's, together with Seventh Generation, both members of your group, recently called for a carbon tax in Vermont. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, and Chris will tell you about that as well. You know, you should remember that nearly all of our environmental laws began as state initiatives, and it's often a really constructive, as Brandeis said, laboratory for experimentation when various states have various schemes. And when they don't always coalesce, that's a wonderful moment to create a federal system. So right now we're in an interesting point where, you know, Washington, Oregon, Massachusetts have all looked at carbon taxes, Vermont included. And Ben & Jerry's and Seventh Generation and other Vermont companies not only have advocated for the carbon tax, but they have educated their employees and consumers accordingly. And I believe that they actually organized a full-on advocacy day where their employees could come forward and work the State House. And that's real leadership. Now, I don't know the chances of the passage of the carbon tax. Chris will have to tell you that for Vermont. But what's important is that this idea has been socialized and normalized so that it's not a far-off notion anymore, the way I could honestly tell you it would have been 4 years ago. At the federal level, there's an incredibly robust conversation going on with conservative and libertarian groups as well as left-leaning groups on how constructive it would be to have an actual carbon tax. And yes, you can say the word carbon tax in Washington. Now, unfortunately, we've seen at Congress, we've seen a bit of a mixed bag, and we've seen some holdouts who have signed an anti-tax pledge, you know, say no just before even before we've been able to experiment with a carbon tax. I believe those efforts are going to diminish rapidly, though, because the wave of opinion is definitely toward pricing the thing you don't want, and all the economists agree that this is the efficient way to go. So there's devils in the details, and there are different distributional models that have to be examined very carefully. But what's exciting is that there's a really constructive bipartisan, I like to say postpartisan, conversation going on about how we could get this done. And honestly, that's something I haven't seen in the last several years of doing this work. And I think all of this is bolstered by the Paris Agreement and the accomplishment that represents.
Yes, and our listeners can take heart. I think there really is a conversation that's very positive happening under the radar in Washington, D.C. about carbon pricing. And we don't have time to go more into it right now, but for our listeners who are interested, I recently interviewed Jerry Taylor, who used to be one of the main people speaking out against acting around climate change. He was one of the leading climate deniers, and he's now converted and turned around, and he's a climate change action champion. So he, on this program recently, laid out what we can all do to help make that shift and to help turn climate deniers into climate action people, as he did. So I encourage our listeners to listen to that show. But with our remaining couple of minutes here, I just wanted to say I attended your wonderful conference in Boston recently and saw some of the participants were industry leaders, like we know the wonderful Ben and Jerry's, who we're talking with shortly, and Stonyfield, who's be on the show next week. But what really surprised me was the very high level of participation of Fortune 500 companies like PepsiCo, General Motors, and Levi Strauss. And how are we doing in terms of the outreach to some of these larger companies, and how serious are they about really doing sustainability and not just greenwashing so they look good to their customers?
Yeah, well, you know, we feel strongly about this question. This goes to the heart of our work, once again. And I would say that most of the companies that we work with, and certainly all of the companies that are in the Bicep Coalition, are deeply committed to real change and real operational change. I would say that the check and balance on this really comes from at least three places. One is investors who are paying attention, and investors are very savvy and sensitive to greenwashing versus real change. The second is customers and employees, and if anyone knows who has a millennial in their household, that they are seeking to work for companies that are truly sustainable. And I've heard this from a number of sources. We suspected this 10 years ago, but there wasn't data on it, but now there's real data that if you want to retain good talent, you actually have to have an answer to the question of what are you doing about climate and energy and sustainability to your new prospective employee. So that's another check and balance on whether your efforts are real. And thirdly, I think just the rise of social media, so that, you know, you can run but you can't hide from the social media mosh pit of criticism that's out there if you do something wrong. And I was thrilled and delighted with the way that Volkswagen was attacked after its fraudulent actions. I think it's much more difficult to get away with the green sheen these days when there's much more integrity built into what most companies do. So I think with those three checks and balances, and of course the larger coalition of public interest groups are really helpful in critiquing corporate action. So oftentimes companies will say no good deed goes unpunished. I often say no good deed goes unscrutinized in this,
right,
in the 21st century.
Yeah, and there's so much transparency now.
Yes, but the colleagues I work with appreciate that because I think mm-hmm. they want to be held to a high standard. And we as consumers need to make sure that we're continuing to ask the good questions.
Fantastic. And just before we sign off, for our listeners who want to learn more about your important work, you can go to Ceres.org. That's Ceres.org, and lift your spirits about some of the most amazing work happening in the world to bring about sustainability and a vibrant economy with a vibrant planet. That's all the time we have. Ann Kelly, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Eleanor.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Will do. Good.
Our next guest is Chris Miller, the Social Mission Activism Manager at Ben & Jerry's, a unique position within the corporate world. Chris is responsible for the development and execution of the company's issue advocacy campaigns that are rooted in its progressive values. Ben & Jerry's has a long history of running campaigns on issues as diverse as support for mandatory GMO labeling, marriage equality, money in politics, and climate change. Before joining Ben & Jerry's, Chris led the sustainability work at Seventh Generation, the leader in natural, non-toxic household and personal care products. In addition to his for-profit experience, Chris directed Greenpeace USA's national climate change campaign and served on the staff of then-Congressman Bernie Sanders. He currently serves as the chair of the board of directors of CarShare Vermont, is the vice chair of the board of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, and is a board member at the Vermont Public Interest Research Group. Chris Miller, welcome to All Together Now.
Eleanor, great to be here. Thank you.
You sound like a very busy fellow.
I love this title.
I love your title of Social Mission Activism Manager. What exactly does that mean?
It's probably the best job in the world. I am essentially, I like to describe it as I'm a campaigner with ice cream. So, the work that I did at Greenpeace or the issue advocacy work that I've done over the years is really what I'm doing within the context of Ben & Jerry's. And I think it's an incredibly potentially powerful opportunity that we have, that both I have and that the company has, to engage in issues and to advance progressive social change. I think particularly for our fans and consumers, millennials, young people who, you know, in many cases, and this is not a good thing, but in many cases don't have faith in the political process, care about issues and don't really know how to make a difference. And so what we try and do at Ben & Jerry's and through our campaigns is to really provide an opportunity for our fans and consumers who care about these issues that we work on to help them take action in a way that hopefully makes the world a little bit better, that supports sort of change in the world. So it's a great gig.
And I hope you heard our conversation with Ann Kelly at Ceres, where she was singing the praises of Ben & Jerry's as one of the national leaders in socially and environmentally responsible companies. So what are your current priorities? What are you working on now?
Yeah, so I think, you know, we sort of think about the work that we do as in two broad buckets. And the first is, I would sort of categorize as impact, right? Our business has impacts across the full value chain. We have positive impacts and we have negative impacts. And so if you think about things like negative impacts, you're thinking about wastewater from our manufacturing plants, you're thinking about energy use, you're thinking about, you know, the emissions associated with our logistics network, and you're thinking about the impacts that come from our single biggest impact area, which is dairy farming. And you're also thinking about the good things that we do in the world, paying livable wage at our manufacturing plants and sourcing fair trade ingredients, et cetera. But that first broad bucket is the impacts, good and bad, that we have as a business. And, you know, obviously the goal here is to, you know, increase the good and stop doing less of the bad. So in terms of that area, I think one of our big focuses at the moment is around the greenhouse gas footprint of our business. It is relatively sizable, and it's driven, as I said, by dairy farming. More than 40% of the overall emissions of a pint of chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream in your freezer comes from on-farm methane emissions. Both from enteric emissions from the cow, the front end and back end of the cow, as well as manure management systems. So we're really working hard to focus on innovative ways to reduce the impacts of dairy farming. And that looks like better feed practices for cows. It looks like installing on-farm biodigesters that turn methane from manure into clean energy. It looks like manure separators that capture methane emissions and also create a byproduct that's used for bedding on farms. So, you know, that's a big area of focus for us. You know, product innovation is an important one. We've recently launched a non-dairy line, so a vegan line that doesn't use milk or cream from cows. That line is a spectacular product, and it has a third less emissions per pint than dairy. So we can focus on sort of product innovations that can help reduce our footprint. So that's kind of, in terms of the impacts that we have as a business, that's been a real strong priority and focus for us over the last several years. I will just add on the sort of influence side, so that's the kind of campaign side, the opportunities we have to engage citizens, fans, consumers on these issues. We're currently focused on a campaign that we're calling Democracy is in Your Hands, and I won't go into great detail, but the idea here is that there are two sort of corrosive sides of the same coin in our democracy. The first is unlimited, unregulated, undisclosed amounts of money in our political system. And then there is this coordinated attempt in a number of states across the country to restrict access to the voting booth. So this is policies that do things like reduce the amount of time that vote by mail can happen, making it more complicated to register to vote, requiring IDs in order to cast your ballot, and that those two things are really driving deep inequities within our society. So it's the sort of priority focus for us on the campaign or influence side.
So it sounds like you're doing great work, both in terms of what Ben & Jerry's is doing with the operations of, you know, how they run the company, and even backing into how are the suppliers contributing to global climate change and what can be done about that. So a real in-depth look at kind of the whole cycle of your operations, and also very outspoken in terms of advocacy. And you talk about Democracy is in Your Hands. I know recently, I believe both Ben and Jerry were both involved in the Democracy Spring, Democracy Alliance activities in D.C., where there was civil disobedience and demonstrations daily for 10 days to try to get Congress to take measures to get money out of politics. So how significant is that in your portfolio of work that you do?
It is the primary focus of our kind of advocacy campaigning at the moment. We believe, what was so, I think, exciting about what happened over the course of the week of Democracy Spring and Democracy Awakening was that you had a coming together, a mobilization of groups that have a very disparate set of interests and issues that they work on, and that typically don't have a history of playing particularly well together. So, but I think we've all come to the conclusion that that any issue that we care about, if we are ultimately to make progress on the greatest issues that face our country, whether that's issues around income inequality and income stagnation, it's climate change, it's the attack on voting rights, that ultimately, all of that depends on a healthy and functioning democracy. So it was incredibly, I think, exciting to see the groups that came together from the NAACP, the labor unions, the environmental groups, faith groups, all coming together over the course of that week. And yes, to your point, Ben and Jerry, as well as myself and several other employees of the company, were participated in the act of civil disobedience, got arrested, and I think what I will say is, as impressive as it was, the wide coalition of groups, we were disappointed that we were the only company that endorsed the Democracy Awakening weekend, and I think We are increasingly seeing corporations becoming more active on areas of issues and advocacy. If you think about the corporate response to HB2 in North Carolina, and I think the case we want to make is to hope to bring other corporations along to support this idea of getting money out of politics and getting more people into the process.
Right, it's very impressive, and by the way, I should say that on the Democracy, Spring Democracy Alliance work, I was helping out with some stage management at the time. So part of what surprised me for our listeners who have not heard of Democracy, Spring Democracy Alliance, we didn't get the press coverage that it would deserve, but it was 10 days of daily action, daily civil disobedience on the steps of the U.S. Capitol, where over 1,300 people got arrested, including some very notable folks like Ben and Jerry, you just mentioned, and Francis Moore LePay was there. So if our listeners want to learn more about that, you can listen to my interview with Frankie LePay right after that, a couple of weeks ago. And Frankie at the time talked about how it was the most important and meaningful day of her life, that she is so concerned about the money that's in politics and the need for us to take action. And as you say, to see that so many of the groups came together, it was over 200 organizations worked together in coalition to have that series of demonstrations. So, and I guess I'm not surprised that Ben and Jerry are the only companies involved, but I would think a lot more companies would like to be involved at some level, even if not at the level of doing civil disobedience. But a lot of these companies are feeling pressed in terms of the members being pressured to contribute to this campaign or that campaign, and as American citizens being concerned, all of us, about the influence of big money in politics. So hats off to the work you're doing there.
Thank you. It's and I think to your point, the important point here is, and one would not expect other necessarily CEOs or corporate leaders to stand on the steps of the United States Capitol and get arrested, but I do think so many of the companies, that for example took a position on HB2 in North Carolina, have government affairs teams, have lobbyists who talk to lawmakers every day about issues. And I think it's our hope that more companies will use their influence with policymakers to really highlight this as an issue that is of concern to them and to their businesses. So I think that's the hope.
Right, very good. And we know, of course, that the influence of money on our Congress is one of the, if not the major reason why we're not getting any progress visibly on putting a price on carbon, even though it's widely recognized as the single most effective step that we could take would be to put a price on carbon to enable to reduce carbon emissions. But you have, once again, setting the pace here. Ben and Jerry's just announced supportive legislation in Vermont to tax carbon. So tell us about the bill that you're supporting and how likely it is that you think it'll be passed.
Yeah. I think all of us, and I know Ann and many of the companies that we work with within the BICEP program that Ceres has run, understand that ultimately we can't solve the issue of global climate change without a price on carbon. We cannot continue to let companies, whether it's Ben and Jerry's, or the Duke Energy, continue to pump pollution into the atmosphere at no cost, understanding there is a great cost to the planet and to people around the world. And so we've done a couple of things. The first is we instituted last year an internal price on carbon. That's right. So we do an annual assessment of our overall emissions, and that's across the full life cycle of our company and its impact. So from farm to landfill, when you throw away that pine container. and we assessed a $10 a ton fee on the full life cycle emissions, and we take that money and we are investing it in our supply chain to reduce the impact of the business, to reduce the footprint of the business. And so that's how we're funding things like the on-farm manure separators, biodigesters, et cetera. So we did that for two reasons, both so that we could, across the business, have people thinking about their impact and looking for ways to reduce emissions within the business, but then also because we wanted it to be a proof point that not only is this not detrimental to business, that it can actually drive innovation and mm-hmm. over time efficiencies that are actually good for business. And so there is a proposal that a coalition of groups and companies are supporting in the state of Vermont that would put a price on carbon. We actually, on the electricity sector, as I'm sure you know, are currently covered under the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which is a cap-and-trade system that exists across the Northeast and several mid-Atlantic states. So this carbon tax proposal from Vermont would cover everything except the electricity sector. So you're talking about things like natural gas, fuel for automobiles, so liquid fuels, home heating oil, that sort of thing. And the proposal would do several things. It would ratchet up a price.
Well, wait a minute, just before we get into that legislation, which I really want to hear about it, but I may have missed this, but are there other companies that have internally put a price on carbon?
Yes, there are. Actually, there are a number of companies that are doing it, and companies big and small. So one of our friends just down the road here in Burlington, Vermont, called Seventh Generation, where I used to work and do, laundry detergent. They've instituted an internal price on carbon. The Disney Corporation has a internal company-wide price on carbon. Microsoft has a company-wide internal price on carbon. And so,
wow, that's really impressive.
It is, and it really is a tool that you know, I think is incredibly helpful in, as I said, sort of getting different units across a company to focus on efficiencies. If you know, in the case of a company, as you could imagine, like Disney, that has multiple business units, right? They have theme parks, they have cruise lines, they have hotels, etc. And so each of those units is given a carbon budget or allowance for the year. And if you're running one of those units, if you come in under budget, under your carbon allotment, you then have the ability to it's essentially an internal cap and trade system, and so they're able to sell credits to other units that may exceed their cap for the given year. And so there are real incentives across the business units to look for innovative ways to reduce emissions, and that then goes directly to your business unit's bottom line. So it is a powerful tool that I think works incredibly well in a company setting, but it also highlights the fact that this would work incredibly well at the economy wide level as well.
Right. I think that's so important, and as you say, when you set up this kind of an internal price on carbon, it can really drive innovation and efficiency. It's a sensible business tool. It's not what a lot of the alarmists are saying, well, you can't do that, you're going to kill business. On the contrary, it's going to drive innovation and efficiency and make companies bigger and stronger. So, and the fact that Disney and Microsoft are doing it tells us that both, you know, it makes sense from a business point of view, and also they're seeing the tea leaves and saying, well, this is going to come anyway, so we might as well get out ahead of the curve.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, companies want, they want stability, they want predictability, and I think, that's part of why that makes this path attractive, is that it puts your business in a posture for what I think, you know, most people would tell you is eventually going to come. It may not be in 6 months, but I think, you know, we're either going to all go off the cliff together, runaway climate change, or if we're actually going to solve this problem, it will absolutely require a price on carbon.
Fantastic. Well, you know, congratulations for Ben and Jerry's doing that and joining that team and leading that. And also, you know, we can't count on the onesies. It's great to have leadership, but it's also, if we can work at a state and federal level, we can get everybody on the same page, and there's no complaints about competitive disadvantage or whatnot. So tell us about this bill in Vermont, and what's it going to do, and can we get it passed?
Yeah. So that point you made is incredibly important, that we cannot solve this problem through individual voluntary corporate action. It is just absolutely not sufficient. So, I think for all those companies who have prioritized the issue of climate and energy and understand that, and I'm sure Anne talked about this as well, that, you know, climate change is a clear and present threat to business and to companies' bottom lines. You know, we're a food company. We purchase ingredients from all over the world, whether it's cocoa from West Africa, vanilla from Madagascar, coffee from Mexico. We're sourcing ingredients that come from places that are increasingly vulnerable from a changing climate. So this is not just because we love trees and polar bears. This is because this is a risk to our business. And I think there are companies big and small all across the American economy and around the world that will tell you that. So that is why, for those of us who advocate and are focused internally, it is equally as important and imperative that companies be willing to have a point of view on pricing carbon at the state, regional, and national level. So here in Vermont, we have more than 200 businesses that have already signed on in support of the proposal. It actually was a proposal that has been floated by these companies and a number of interest groups. It has not yet been introduced. Our legislature is out of session for the year, but we anticipate that the legislation will be introduced when the legislature returns in January. So we really spent this past legislative session educating legislators and having conversations with them to really begin the conversation. But the broad outlines of the proposal is that it would institute a fee on fossil fuel greenhouse gases outside the electricity sector, that it would ramp up or sort of phase in over a 10-year period, and that there would be a couple of things that are done with the revenues that are raised by the carbon tax. The first is that there would be a cut in the corporate tax rate. The second is that there would be investments in weatherization and efficiency for homes. It's obviously cold in Vermont, and mm-hmm. So if we're going to raise the price of things like natural gas and home heating oil, we want to make sure that we're investing, particularly for low-income Vermonters, in helping their homes be more efficient. The third thing it would do was also return some of the revenue directly back to all taxpayers in the state. So the idea is that, broadly speaking, it would be revenue neutral in that, you know, funds mm-hmm. would not go into the general fund and would not be used for other purposes, but would be to reduce corporate tax rates for business, you know, because businesses would ultimately see an increase in energy prices, perhaps. You would also be looking to ensure that any impacts for low-income people are mitigated through investments in efficiency and through returning some of that revenue to taxpayers.
I think that's a great idea. And is this similar to what was passed and is already operative in British Columbia?
Yes, it's not dissimilar at all from the approach in British Columbia, which has been, by the way, incredibly successful in reducing emissions in the province. And let me say this about this idea of pricing carbon pollution in the state of Vermont. Vermont doesn't have oil, and we don't have natural gas, and we don't have coal. And that means that all of the energy that we use to heat our homes, to drive our cars, all of that money is going outside the state of Vermont. And one of the, I think, the real powerful benefits of this kind of proposal is that it will do two things. It will, by definition, over time, reduce the amount of money that we're spending and sending outside the state of Vermont to purchase fossil fuels. And the other thing it's going to do is it's going to incentivize and drive investments in renewable energy, decentralized forms of renewable energy that can be based here in Vermont and keep the energy dollars that Vermonters spend in Vermont. So it not only is it not detrimental to the Vermont economy, the truth is over the course of a 10-year phase-in of this kind of thing, you're talking about keeping, you know, literally millions and hundreds of millions of dollars inside the Vermont economy that would have otherwise, absent this kind of proposal, gone outside the state.
Well, that sounds fantastic. And I know for our listeners who are thinking of what we can do to advance progressive causes, we can now add to our list the most joyous of all, eat more Ben & Jerry's ice cream, and you're going to help save the country and save the world. That's all the time we have. Chris Miller of Ben & Jerry's, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Eleanor. It's been a pleasure.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.